The following Stealing the Mind Bible Conference presentation is by Chuck Missler and is entitled Europe, the Prophetic Stage is Set. For a free catalog of all of our tapes and books, call Compass at 1-800-977-2177 or on the web at compass.org.
Well, good evening. See, I'm ready for dinner, too. How many of you in the audience here are in the full-time ministry? Can I see a show of hands? Oh, come on now. Let me ask you a different question. How many of you are saved by the blood of Jesus Christ? Okay, how many of you are in the full-time ministry, whether you know it or not? All right, we got that out of the way. Okay, good. As many of you know, one of the things that we try to do is keep track of major strategic trends. And so one of the things we've been trying to do is update our perspectives on Europe. We recently had done a thing called Roots of War, an update on the Middle East, and that was one of the... We were startled at the response, not only among our subscribers, but in people in the quarters of power. And so we began to realize that sometimes these perspectives are far more valuable than we at first appreciate. But one of the things I have to tell you, I've been following Europe for some years, at least I thought I did, and I was startled with some of the things we discovered as we started getting into it. But Jesus chided the Pharisees in Matthew 16. When I went to the Naval Academy, I learned that there was an ancient seaman's proverb: red sky at night, sailor's delight; red sky in the morning, sailor take warning. And that really works in the west, in the northern hemisphere. But it was interesting that that was an old proverb, even in the days of Jesus, because he chides the Pharisees that they can discern the face of the sky, but they cannot discern the signs of the times. Now, if he's being critical of them in that day, how much more critical might he be of us? Because we have much more insight than they did on the one hand, and yet most of us are probably not adequately sensitive to the times we're in. Because indeed, it's a red sky in the morning, so sailors take warning. Now, we monitor a number of strategic trends. Most of you are familiar with these that follow our materials. But we're going to focus on the rise of the European superstate. We've been following this for the better part of a decade, and but there are always surprises. Where is Europe in prophecy is one of the questions. Will the Antichrist come from Europe? I've taught that for years, and I'm here to tell you I don't think so. I, like most people, have been guilty of a myopia, because we know from Daniel 9 and other passages he comes from the Roman Empire. But many of us have a myopia and presume that's equivalent to Western Europe. When Micah, Ezekiel, and Isaiah all call him the Assyrian. So there's more to look at this than most people have dug into. Will the European Union eclipse the United Nations? And how will the UN affect the Middle East or the United States, or even more importantly, to us? If I can borrow a phrase from last night. I won't ask for a meow from the group. We'll just go on. Europa Rising is the title of our talk. Just a quick snapshot of things that I'm sure you're familiar with from our materials. If not, you've got some homework to do, because you may recall the strange dream of Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 2 that Daniel is called to interpret. And I'll give you the short version, because I know this is well-traveled ground for most of you. In that dream that becomes so fateful in world history, he sees a metal image, the head of gold, arms and chest of silver, belly and thighs of brass, legs of iron, and then even the feet are iron, but in the feet's case, it's mixed with clay. And Daniel interprets this for you in Daniel 2. And in the dream, a stone cut without hand smites the image at the base, and it grows to become a mountain that fills the whole earth. Pretty weird dream. You were with Nebuchadnezzar, and you were a young king that just took over, trying to challenge and find out, qualify these old cronies that you inherited from your dad. You'd put him to the test too, and that's exactly what he did. He pretended to forget the dream. He says, I want you to tell me the dream and interpret it. Of course, they couldn't do that. And Daniel prayed about it, and he and his gang, and they did. And Daniel not only recounts the dream to validate his presence before Nebuchadnezzar, but then he interprets it for him. He says, you are that head of gold. See, what it is, it's a timeline. It's a timeline of Gentile history. The Bible generally talks about history, both past and future, from the point of view of Israel. But there are a couple of exceptions, and Daniel chapters 2 through 7 are one of those exceptions, where the focus is not Israel, but it's the Gentile dominion on the planet Earth. And it's going to involve four empires. That's a shock. Not three, not seven, not a dozen, four. The first is Babylon, and Daniel interprets it, but you're going to be succeeded by another, and they by another, and then there's this fourth empire that has two phases, apparently. I'll call it Rome Phase 1 and Rome Phase 2. And most scholars recognize that there are that this fourth empire is in two phases. It's not five empires, it's four. There are four metals, gold, silver, brass, and iron. And that will be underscored for us when we get to Daniel 7. Well, indeed, Babylon arose from 606 to 539 B.C., when Cyrus took over Babylon. Cyrus the Persian conquers the Babylonians, and his empire endures until Alexander the Great, at the age of, well, he's in his mid-20s, conquers the Persians. He dies shortly. His four generals divide up the empire, and it endures until 68 B.C. Now, the question is, who conquered Babylon? The Persians. Who conquered the Persians? Greeks. Who conquered the Greeks? The Romans. Who conquered the Romans? Nobody. Just as Daniel portrays, the Roman Empire doesn't get taken over. It breaks up into pieces. And those pieces will, at the end time, recoalesce to begin a foundation of the final phase of that empire. And that is recognized by scholars all through the centuries. It's interesting to read these commentaries by guys like J.A. Sice and others who wrote before the Civil War. So this is not a question of eisegesis that is reading into the text things that are happening, quite the contrary. Now, Daniel 7, God treats Daniel at the end of his days. This earlier thing took place as he was a teenager. At the end of his days, he's now in the Persian Empire. He rises to power there too, strangely. He himself is treated to a series of visions, night visions. The first is a winged lion, a bear on one side. Each one of these visions he sees comes out of the sea, and he likens these strange series of beasts to animals. When he gets to the fourth, when he can't even find an animal, he just calls it the great and terrible beast. And as you get, and by the way, as you get into this, you'll recognize that there's the same four empires that are in Daniel chapter 2. Well, we all know that the civilization started in the area we call the Fertile Crescent, with the ancient empires of Egypt, Assyria, and Babylon. A little city of Babylon grows, of course, to become the Babylon Empire, and it, of course, is succeeded by the Persian Empire, and the Persian Empire by the Greek. Alexander conquered all the way to India. Really a phenomenal young man. And so, what's interesting, four of his generals divided up when he dies. Cassander to the far west, Lysimachus takes over that legion that you and I associate with Turkey. And then Seleucus took the most of it all the way to the east, and Ptolemy took the south, Egypt and so forth. It's interesting that the two strong guys in this foursome are Ptolemy and Seleucus. Many people talk about the silent year, these four centuries that occur between the Old and New Testament. Everybody knows that, you know, our Old Testament closes with the Italian book, Malachi, right? But there are about four centuries before Matthew, and they're called the silent years. I have to tell you, those years are covered in the Bible. They're covered in Daniel chapter 11. These two empires and their subsequent dynasties fight with each other over those four centuries, and the details there in advance are recorded in Daniel 11 with such precision that the skeptics try to argue that Daniel must have been written later. But we're going to just focus on what succeeds all that, and that's the Roman Empire. We'll call it Phase 1. And, of course, Rome conquers Greece about 146 B.C., then 133 B.C., Lysimachus' kingdom falls, then Seleucus at the Battle of Actium, Egypt falls. And just to give you a frame of reference, 44 B.C. is when Julius Caesar gets assassinated. As you move into the church period, Nero begins his persecution about 64 A.D. About 284 A.D., Diocletian divides the empire. The Roman Empire by this time is so large it's not manageable, so he breaks it into two legs. How fascinating. Just as one would imagine from Daniel chapter 2. Constantine takes over, we all know about that, except he is so fed up with the politics at Rome that he moves the capital of the world to Byzantium, renames it Constantinople, the new Rome. The headquarters of the Roman Empire was not in Rome, it was in Byzantium. And the eastern leg of this empire outlived the western leg by over 1,000 years. We overlook that. We tend to give it a different name, so we call it the Byzantine Empire. It's the eastern leg of the Roman Empire. The western leg, that later becomes Europe, fragments into pieces about the end of the 4th century. And each segment, though, that it breaks up has had its era. So, but the important thing as you think of the Roman Empire, it's important for us as scholars to recognize it had an eastern leg. It's not just Europe. That poses some very interesting enigmas on our near-term horizon. Well, as it fractures into pieces, of course, the empire breaks into pieces. Strangely enough, in each of these regions, you've got the Germanic peoples, the Ostrogoths, the Visigoths, and the Franks. It's interesting that the French are descendants from the Germans. They don't like to mention that. And the Anglo-Saxons, the Celts, and so forth. The Muslims come from the south, of course, in their conquests. Fortunately, are stopped at Tours, France, by Charles Martel, or we'd all be speaking Arabic. The Vikings show up. They colonize Iceland, explore Greenland, conquer eastern England, and set up a colony in Dublin, set up colonies on the northern France, and set up the regimes that become in Kiev that become part of the Russian heritage. After all this goes on, the Magog groups, the Magyars, come down and conquer what you and I know as Eastern Europe. Meanwhile, the Muslims have conquered Istanbul, and the last vestige of the Roman Empire falls to Muslim hands about 1450. It's interesting. I'm not going to try to recount the whole history of Europe in this summary, but there are some things I'd like to highlight. It's about the 800 AD that King Charlemagne is crowned as Emperor of the Romans. What a strange label, by Pope Leo III, and that's about 800 AD. It's an empire that doesn't last long, about 40 years, it disintegrates, really. But the idea of the so-called Holy Roman Empire endures strangely throughout history. As we get to the later, in 1871, when Otto von Bismarck and Prussian King William I, they called their empire the Second Empire. Second to what? Second to the first, which was the Roman Empire. In fact, as we go on, of course, we get into the periods that we're probably more familiar with. We have the situation where we have the Balkans are getting ambitious. The Ottoman Empire is starting to fractionate. This is, we're talking about 1912 or so. And so they start cherry-picking some assets, and the tensions build up. Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Italy form a triple alliance. And then Russia, France, and Britain form the Triple Entente. And as the Balkans get tangled up in this and the Triple Alliance begins to back them, suddenly we end up in what was called the Great War, until we learned that we had to number them. World War I. Now, that ended up, of course, after that was over, it ended up dissolving pretty much the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire breaks up into pieces. I want to call your attention to the lower right-hand corner of the slide with a thing called the British Mandate. Very interesting story. We'll develop in the second session after this some background on that. In 1916, a secret treaty was signed between Britain and France that agreed to divide between them the lands of their enemy in the Ottoman Empire once World War I ended. And as an incentive during the war, the Arabs had been promised independent states in the areas that were formerly controlled by Turkey and others. This is known as the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And this is when, under the leadership of General Allenby, and under the tactical supervision of Colonel T.E. Lawrence of Arabia, which has, his exploits were much exaggerated propaganda to serve the purposes of the Foreign Office, Faisal was awarded, anyway, the rule of the newly created state of Iraq, which was a British protective mandate. And the agreement of this this Picot agreement, the Sykes-Picot agreement, causes Britain to abrogate its commitment to the League of Nations and subsequently the UN, and it laid the foundation for all the troubles that we presently experience in the Middle East. But we move on. Britain, of course, gives away 78% of the land that was earmarked for a Jewish homeland by the League of Nations to create this synthetic state called Transjordan. We'll talk about that next time. Meanwhile, Germany is rising to power. Through a shrewd propaganda maneuvers, annexes the Sudetenland. And that's a story you really need to understand, or you won't understand what's going on today among the PLO, but we'll move on. Having annexed the Sudetenland, they quickly overrun the rest of Czechoslovakia, and World War II, of course, begins. And Germany, of course, is going like crazy. Russia invades Finland, and on it goes. And so, to make a quick summary of this, Germany, you know, it's interesting. Hegel's right. History teaches us that man learns nothing from history. If they would have done what the Greeks did and read the writings of Herodotus, which talks about the Scythians, which are the ancestors of the Russians, they were a nomadic group on horseback, and you couldn't attack them because they just retreat. The Scythians developed this concept of defense in depth. They didn't fight, they just retreat. And as you got overextended going after them, they'd encircle you and win. The tactics were very fascinating to the Greeks. Herodotus talks a lot about the Scythians, which is the ancestor. He's the descendant from Magog, and he's the ancestor of the true Russians. If Napoleon had done his homework, you wouldn't have had the overture of 1812 that celebrates this incredible victory of Russia. As Napoleon goes in with 700,000 troops and gets to Moscow, and there's nothing there, not even food, that the genius of the Russians is just to retreat and let the Russian winter do what they could not have done. That as Napoleon retreats, he ends up leaving Russia with not 700,000, with less than 10,000 troops. And that is celebrated, of course, in Tchaikovsky's Overture of 1812. If Hitler had done his homework, he does the same thing. He overextends himself into Russia and, of course, gets set back. Fortunately, we're talking about 1942 by now. But the reason I'm highlighting this, I want you to know something. When Hitler, in his dreams, what did he call his empire that he was aspiring to? The Third Reich. What's the Third? What do you mean the Third? The Third German Reich? No. The Third phase of the Holy Roman Empire. It's strange how this concept of the Holy Roman Empire, from Charlemagne on, haunts Europe. It never. Voltaire summarized it beautifully. He says it was neither holy, nor a Roman, nor an empire. It's just a concept. But it's a concept that's beginning to surface today. Well, of course, after World War II, all these independent states surface with problems, and so the new Europe begins to emerge. And in 1951, some great visionaries realized that the only way you can unite Europe would be to unite its economies, and the way you start with those is with the heavy industries. So they formed an entity called the European Coal and Steel Community, which had a very innovative concept. It had a multinational commission in charge of the industries, the heavy industries, in Europe, primarily involving six signatories: France, Germany, Italy, and the three Benelux countries, Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg. It was so successful, doing an impossible job, that it became the model for a new set of treaties in 1957, March 25, the Treaties of Rome, which formed two other communities. In addition to coal and steel community, they now added the European Atomic Energy Commission, community, and the European Economic Community. The press picked up the nickname Common Market to summarize all of this. In 58, they formed a European Parliament, and I remember those years well. Most Americans weren't even aware that there was such a thing as a European Parliament in existence. The Benelux formed. In 1967, a merger occurred. The commissions of the European Economic Community, the Coal and Steel Community, and the Atomic Energy Community merged, forming a new entity, which was properly called the European Union. Excuse me, the European Community. In 73, Denmark, Ireland, and the UK join. Greece joins in 81. In 73, we all got excited because, you see, we had an original six with Denmark, Ireland, and the UK joining. We now had nine. And then when Greece joined in 81, wow, there were 10. And I fell in the trap, like most people, wow, there's 10 there, you know. We didn't do our homework. You see, it doesn't say 10 are going to come together. 10 kings emerge out of the combination, ultimately. So we've got to be very, when you're in eschatology especially, you need to be very precise with your definitions. God means what he says, and he says what he means. And Jesus warned us. He says, I come not to destroy the Torah or the prophets, I come not to destroy but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, not one jot or one tittle shall pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Now a jot or a tittle are Hebraism, equivalent to our crossing the T or dotting an I. And So we want to be very precise. Well, of course, Spain and Portugal joined the 10, so now we got 12. That's embarrassing. It was a single European act. That's important, but we'll be on. The Germans unify. But then in 1993, a major event occurs. Many people aren't familiar with how significant it was, and that is the Maastricht Treaty replaced the Treaty of Rome. The Maastricht, that's a town in the Netherlands what was signed, what gets its name. But this is where we start recognizing that it calls for a common military, a common foreign policy, a common currency, and a common judiciary. And that's where they're going. Now, the question that's now in front of us, is an empire being revived? I'm not saying it is. I think we need to gather all our facts and just watch and see. The Maastricht Treaty, obsoleted the Treaty of Rome, centralized European superstate, common foreign policy, common military, common currency, common judicial proposal. 1993. I had a chance to interview over 40 of the top leaders in 9 countries that were involved in this, getting the Maastricht Treaty signed. And in each country, it was chicanery behind the scenes that ultimately finesses this treaty into existence. The international socialists are very powerful, very organized, and straddle borders. The economic potential of what's emerging in front of our eyes has a potential of being larger than the United States. It has a population base that's 446 million versus our 280 million. And there's more to come. Let's move on. After the Maastricht Treaty, we have 3 other nations join: Austria, Sweden, and Finland. Now, that causes them to realize there's going to be more members. So in Copenhagen, they established the Copenhagen criteria. In June of 1993, the European Council set up these criteria: stability of institutions which will guarantee democracy, rule of law, human rights, and respect for and protection of minorities, and a functioning market economy that has the capacity to cope with the competitive pressures and market forces within the Union. Now, it's interesting, they're not setting up barriers, they're setting up goals that the European Union is financing the candidates to climb over. And it's a very interesting thing. They also have require adherence to the aims of the political, economic, and monetary union. Now, what most people are only superficially aware of is there are new countries joining the European Union. Next January, we have 10 new members, the Central European states of Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Slovenia. Then we have the 3 Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. And then we have 2 little islands, Cyprus and Malta, are joining the European Union in January. What's the impact of these? Well, let's take a look at the EU, first of all, today. There are 5 institutions. We won't get into all of them. I don't want to pass the, without mention at least, the Commission, of course. That's the executive branch. The Council of Ministers, they report to. The European Parliament. The European Parliament has a very fascinating insignia. It's a woman riding a beast, and if you look at this postage stamp, you'll notice that beast is riding 7 hills. That's kind of fun. I'll explain a little bit of it in a minute. International Court of Justice, the Court of Auditors, and the European Council. And something we'll talk about briefly is the European Central Bank. Now, many people get all excited about this woman riding the beast business, and you need to understand it's not taken from the Bible, it's taken from Greek mythology. It deals with the myth of the Greek god Zeus and a legendary beauty, Europa. This young princess is one that the god Zeus fell in love with. He changed himself into a bull, carried her off to the island of Crete, where she bore him 3 sons. And this is celebrated in a very famous painting, The Rape of Europa, by an Italian artist in about the 16th century. The European continent may have been named after Europa. That's the common conjecture. But in case the enlargement's continuing here, and over almost 70% of the direct investment goes into those candidate countries. Over 6 years, the total trade has increased 300%, over $200 billion per year. But here's the interesting thing. Europe operates its international trade profitably. It earns over 25 billion euros per day. Excuse me, per year. 25 billion, almost 26 billion per year. To give that, put that in perspective, we operate our international trade at a deficit. Our trade deficit this year is estimated to be about 548 billion. Negative, not positive. You see the difference? Okay, it's one of the more serious deficits we have. The European community gives about 3 billion a year direct assistance to their candidate members through 3 different programs. I won't bore you with that, but 3 billion a year is a lot of money. The current candidates, as I've mentioned, there's 10. We'll take a quick look at them. We have Poland, of course, is joining. It has a population of about 38 million. We'll just hit these very quickly. We have Hungary, of course, and it's got a population of 10 million. And we have the Czech Republic, and it has a population of about 10 million. And I'll give you a summary of this in a minute so you don't have to jot these things down. Slovenia has a population of about 5 million. And we have Slovakia and Slovenia. And then we have Estonia with a population of under 2 million. And in the Balkan countries. And then we have Latvia and a population of over 2 million. The interesting one is Lithuania, because it cuts off Russia from Kaliningrad, and the Russians have to get passports from the Lithuanians to get to part of their own country. But in any case, they have a population of almost 4 million, and they're also joining. So then we have two island nations, Malta, just a small thing. But by the way, one of the most exciting things that we're going to participate in will be in March, end of April, March, is a cruise to Malta, where Bob Cornuke and a group here are going to be presenting to the government of Malta the anchors of Paul that have been found and ratified out of Acts 27. And it's not only a chance to see it, it's a chance to participate in history. The implications of that discovery are absolutely staggering, far more than would meet the eye. So we're going to be celebrating that with the government of Malta in April. We're doing it in the form of a cruise, which includes, of course, Corinth, Athens, Patmos, and all that. You can check it out. We have the brochures that are available at the table if you're interested. Malta is primarily tourist, and it's going to be growing for lots of very interesting reasons. And it's right there, just below Italy, if you will. There is Cyprus. It's complicated because of the Turkish relationship in the northern part of the island, but it also is scheduled to join. And it's right there in the eastern Mediterranean. So again, we have two other countries that are scheduled to join in 2007, Bulgaria and Romania. I'll leave Turkey for a separate discussion because they're not really scheduled and there's a great debate going on. And I'll talk about that in a minute. But Romania is a population of about 22 million. And we have Bulgaria, which has a population of about 15 million. And so that's the new Europe that you see on the map. The dark blue is the existing Europe as it stands today. The light blue are the ones that are joining in January. The Balkans and Poland, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, and Slovenia. The pink ones on the map are the two that are joining in 2007, Romania and Bulgaria. And Turkey, I'll leave as a special case. In fact, Turkey is a very strategic country because it bridges Europe with Asia, and since it's a major player in Bible prophecy, we want to understand what's going on there. And there is an optimism. When I was at the Air War College a few weeks ago, I was an invited civilian participant in the National Security Forum, and I had a chance to spend some time with some top Turkish officers, and they are very optimistic of becoming part of the European Union. I want to say that in candor with you, but at the same time, I have to share with you reasons I'm skeptical. I told them why I am, for a number of reasons. We'll look at that. You're talking about a country that has over 65 million population. Well, let's take a quick look at Turkey. You need to understand the commitments that they made after they emerged after World War I of the remnants of the Ottoman Empire. And that's where the modern state of Turkey was formed from that. Ataturk, Kemal Ataturk, took aggressive commitments to be part of the West. In 1922, he abolished the Sultanate. In 24, the Caliphate and the religious courts. In 1925, he made it illegal to wear a fez because he regarded it as a symbol of backwardness. And having rid Turkey of the trappings of Islam, he then joined. In 1925, he changed their calendar. Can you imagine changing the calendar of a culture? He adopted the Swiss Civil Code. He switched to the Latin alphabet in 1928. In 31, the metric system, and in 34, all the Turks were obliged to take a surname. The only place he messed up, he gave the women the vote, but that's you can't score in all places. I'm kidding. I'm going to hear about that. Following World War II, they joined all the Western institutions, the UN in 45. They're a member of the United Nations. the IMF in 47, the OECD in 48, the Council of Europe in 49, NATO, they're a member of NATO, very important, 1951. And in 1963, call it 40 years ago, they received associate membership in the European Community on the stipulation that they would be granted, ultimately, membership. And so the crisis began to loom in about 1987, when they applied for full membership in the European Community, and their application was ahead of Austria, Finland, Sweden, Norway, whose applications were accepted and expedited. So it's now become clear to them that they're not welcome. And that's a tremendous blow after spending 70 years trying to be a member of the West, discovering that they're not welcome. Now, we saw some of this under the pressures of Iraq. You remember Turkey declined the U.S. use of its bases despite a commitment of $80 billion in aid? You've got to be kidding. Turkey lost its largest trading power in the previous war, 12 years earlier. Pressured by France, of course, because France has its hands dirty in terms of contracts with Iraq and the rest of it. But you need to be sensitive as we go forward here with the anti-U.S. sentiment in both Germany and France, in fact, all through Europe. And that's a factor. But the deferrals by the European Union is one of the strategic changes you want to watch. The opening up of the Turkic world of Central Asia is a second factor. But I think that the bellwether here is the rise of Islamic fundamentalism in Turkey. Here is a list of the Muslims in Europe today. France is about 7.5% Muslim, Netherlands 4.4%, Germany 3.9%, Britain 3.3%, and so on. That's a total of about 13 billion, call it maybe 14 million Muslims in Europe. If Turkey comes in, they bring in 63 million Muslims more. And no one wants to talk about it that way, but as Islamic as Europe is in some respects, that is too much of a pill for them to swallow, I suspect. Now, why are we dwelling on Turkey? Because of their role in Ezekiel 38 and 39. Because Meshech and Tubal were principal cities in Anatolia, which constitutes the eastern three-fourths of the nation Turkey. And although they're presently pro-West, the 16 generals that run the country have signed 16 military assistance pacts with Israel. So Turkey today is an ally of Israel. That gives Israel control de facto of the northern border of Syria. And they trade air bases and so on. But we know from Ezekiel 38 that there's going to be an invasion armed and led by Magog. And all the and they're obviously the people that are in the extreme parts of the north, as the Bible talks about. And if you go through all the tribal things, you know that this invasion of Israel is going to be the occasion that God intervenes on behalf of Israel. And because of the description of what appears to be nuclear weapons in Ezekiel 39, it's a well-known passage I'm sure most of you are familiar with. Those of you that have done your homework eschatologically, you know that the most documented period of time in the Bible, both Old and New Testament, is a seven-year period that we commonly call the 70th week of Daniel, interrupted in the middle by this peculiar event called the Abomination of Desolation. And the last half of that seven-year period was labeled by Jesus Christ himself as the Great Tribulation. He was quoting Daniel 12, but that's where we get that strange label. The tribulation is not 7 years, it's 3.5 years, by Christ's own definition. And we know the temple will be standing by the middle of that seven-year period. We don't know what's going to be built before or after the beginning of that week. We don't know. We do know it's standing by the middle of that week. The Battle of Armageddon is at the end of that week, which of course leads to the second coming in this period that we call the millennium. Now the question that gets raised here is, where does the Magog invasion take place? And it is classically placed by many scholars at the end of that seven-year period. And I'll use Hal Lindsey as the exemplar of current scholarship, which still would argue that that's where it occurs. I think Hal and Dave Hunt and some other very reputable guys hold that view, and they may prove to be correct. But there's a number of us, Grant Jeffries, myself, Chuck Smith, and others, have reasons to believe the Scripture suggests that it's going to occur prior to, maybe some distance before, the 70th week. The one thing we all do agree on, the group that I've talked about, is that it occurs after the rapture of the church. Now, that puts us in a very peculiar position because there's evidence that the Ezekiel 38 event is being positioned on our geopolitical horizon as we speak. But if that's true, then the rapture is even closer. So I'm not setting dates, don't misunderstand me. In fact, to the extent that the rapture is close, that should excite you on the one hand, but also it's an approaching deadline. What you're going to do for Christ, you better do now. If there's someone you love that has yet to discover Christ, you better pray them into the kingdom. Let's move on. Something else to get perspective here. NATO redefined itself on its 50th birthday. The 15 nations that formed it as a defensive alliance against Russia now have to redefine their mission because Russia is deemed as a friend. So they redefine themselves as a world police force, and that scared a lot of people. And the response to that move was the Shanghai Pact, where Russia, China, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan signed a treaty of common commitment to resist the hegemony of the United States. And to give you a feeling of this, this is Russia on the screen. There's China. There's most, not all, but most of Central Asia. They have signed a military assistance pact, and they practice about every 14 months military maneuvers together that have the purpose of training their officers to fight the United States. That's kind of exciting. Well, where are we going in the future? Well, let's take another look at there are 48 political units that could theoretically make up Europe. And the ones that are listed in light blue on the screen are the ones that are already there. The ones that are listed in orange are the 12 that are scheduled to enter in the near horizon. Now, these nations, it's not going to be a picnic. Remember, Daniel said the iron is mixed with clay. This union of 25 going on 27 countries has 38 languages among them. And there are in 8 different language groups, actually. So that's a formidable challenge in itself. Single foreign policy? You've got to be kidding. There are several traditional, Sweden, Finland, and Ireland are traditional neutrals. UK, France, and Portugal, and Spain have colonies. These are all in violation of the avowed common interest here. A permanent UN Security Council seats. UK and France currently hold 2 of the 5 permanent seats. Now, the eastward expansion of the European Union is going to double their EU membership. And, of course, there's other issues. Composite defense, not all are members of NATO. Sweden, Finland, and Ireland are not, of course. Norway is within NATO, but not in the EU. That's another complication. Nuclear weapons. France and UK possess nuclear weapons. Are they going to share them? Are they going to pool them? You can't visualize any of that happening. And, of course, there's all kinds of differing foreign policies. I was startled to realize that Europe approximates the gross domestic product of the United States. But I'll come back to this one in a minute. That's as it stands now, without these additions, incidentally. Here's an economic summary. Europe makes about 9.2 trillion euros a year in the composite economy. The ones that they're adding are going to add up to about 384 billion euros in 2004 and another 60 billion in 2007. Here are the summary figures on the chart. The net of this, here's the United States for reference. We have a gross domestic product of about $10 trillion. And we have a population base of 280 million. The combined new Europe will have about 9.6 trillion GDP and on a base of 446 million population. In other words, they will have about they have 60% larger population than the U.S. today. But there's more to the story. R&D investment, of course, we lead EU and Japan, but notice EU spends substantially more on R&D than even Japan does. The world energy consumption is the problem. We consume about 25%, but we also produce a large portion of it. European Union consumes 16% and growing. Here's the real problem. On this chart, you'll see the consumption, the production in blue and the consumption in red. And with exception of the United Kingdom, you'll find that most of them are desperately in need of energy. They consume far more than they can supply. And that's why the Middle East is so crucial. For the United States, you're talking maybe 10 or 15% criticality. But if you're talking Europe, it's a whole different story. And they produce very little, of course. I won't go through all that here. There's another side to this, and that's common currency. The Romans used, one of the powers of the Roman Empire was common coinage. And the common coinage is one of the things that united that. And I won't go through the whole history of monetary unions. That's not that critical. Except, obviously, the euro has been introduced as a legal currency in 12 of the 15 member states so far. But here's what, in central bank reserves around the world, the U.S. dollar is about 68%, the euro is about 13%. But the point is, the central banks throughout the world are increasing their percentage of euros and shifting reserves for lots of reasons. The bond markets are going to be doing pretty much the same thing. But here's one of the things that surprises a lot of people. Let's take a look at how the euro has been doing. The euro is now worth over a dollar. At the time I snapshot this chart, it was about $1.19. If you correct the European economy today, I'm adding the members in, but leaving it today's economy, they're equivalent to about 11.5 trillion U.S. dollars, meaning that they are about 14% larger than the United States is today. And that's a shocker. Now, there's some other sides to this, and they're doing this on a population base that's 60% larger, and a population base that will be converting from agricultural to industrialization over the years. Now, the mean income is obviously very small in those countries. We have a mean income of about 35,000, call it 36,000 a year nominal. The EU members are about 27. These new members that are joining are 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 a year. They're very poor countries. They're primarily agrarian. But they will be industrializing and bringing it up. The difference is, see, we all of us lay off our low-cost labor to low-cost zones. Trade is accounting to an increased percentage of our economic activity. We are increasingly dependent on the rest of the world. Jobs are always shift to the low-cost regions. The United States is becoming a consumer rather than a producer. Imports account for 25% of all the economic transactions in the United States. That was against 14% a couple of decades ago. And, of course, our trade deficits are gigantic. But what's interesting is the trade as a percent of GDP is increasing. We're getting increasingly dependent on that while we shift our jobs offshore. We shed 2.4 million jobs since 2001. Technology jobs are also leaving the U.S., especially for Asia. Services also. So what I'm getting at is, the key point I wanted to make here, just to back up for a second, as we shift off our jobs, those countries, be it Asia or Mexico, are upgrading. But they're not in our tax base. Europe shifts its jobs to the Eastern Bloc that are joining them. So as they upgrade those countries, they're upgrading participants in their tax base. You see the genius of it. So, of course, there's the issue of global government. The UN participation is a big issue. And I won't get into the whole UN politics. The big enigma, I was surprised to discover that Europe spends more on the UN than we do. They have 37% of the regular budget versus our 23%. In peacekeeping, they spend 40% versus our 28%. I didn't realize that. That startled me. And I won't get into the politics of that, but it may be that the EU will either take over the UN or the EU may simply eclipse the UN. We'll just watch and see. The Constitution, of course, has expressly rejected any mention of God and Christianity. That was a big debate, but it's now gone to the 25 members. The National Anthem, of course, is in... The National Anthem is Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, perhaps the most beautiful piece of music ever written. The choral movement. We shocked the musical world with the choral movement, and you need to understand the words. The music is fabulous. The words are Freude, Fruchter aus Elysium, deine Zauber binden wieder, was die Mode spektiert. Alle Menschen werden wieder, wo dein Sanster Flügel weilt. What is that in English? O daughter of Elysium, thy pure magic frees all others held in customs' rigid wings. Men throughout the world are brothers in the haven of thy wings. It's a call to global brotherhood and fellowship. Interesting. Very fascinating. So what's next? Will an eastern leg emerge? I don't know. Let's watch and see. When and where will a super leader emerge? I don't think we'll see that. I think that's post-rapture. I do believe he's called the Assyrian by Micah 5, Isaiah 10, and several passages in Ezekiel. What will the role of Babylon be? The most important city in Iraq was never mentioned on the news. And it's going to emerge, I believe, in the news as a major player. Are the references in the scripture literal or symbolic? I believe they're both. And the Zechariah 5 is the key to that. But here's the challenge. You and I are being plunged into a period of time about which the Bible says more than it does about any other period of time in human history. And that includes the time that Jesus walked the shores of Galilee and climbed the mountains of Judea. Now, there are 10 strategic trends that we will monitor. Every one of them has biblical relevance. Every one of them is moving exactly as the Bible has predicted. With that, Bill, I am there. Did we make it?
To receive a free catalog of all of our Bible teaching books and tapes, information on upcoming Bible conferences in your area, or details of our missionary outreach, call 800-977-2177 24 hours a day or on the web at compass.org.